NPR Music and the Tiny Desk Contest. Capital One, what's in your wallet? And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, it's the place to find NPR News. Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 in Junction City. Our forecast today, sunny and hot. It'll be in the upper 80s today, mostly clear tonight, low 60s. And a good chance for showers, especially tomorrow afternoon. Otherwise humid with lows, or rather highs, in the lower 80s. 76 degrees here at KU in Lawrence, 75 in Topeka.
You're listening to NPR News.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. Thanks for joining us on this Saturday morning, the 6th of July. Coming up, How the Light Gets In, a conversation with author Joyce Maynard about her latest novel, which is a sequel to 2021's Count the Ways. Conversation with Joyce Maynard coming up in the next half hour of Weekend Edition Saturday. Support for Weekend Edition on KPR comes from the Topeka and Shawnee County Public Libraries summer events, including Blockbuster Wednesdays in June and July, with kid-friendly performances including a magician, science, and more. Three different performance times every Wednesday. Details at tscpl.org. What's the weather forecast, you ask? In a nutshell, hot and sunny. Today, highs in the upper 80s. We'll see a mostly clear night, mid-60s overnight, and tomorrow much different. Partly sunny in the morning, chance of thunderstorms in the morning, chance of showers in the afternoon, too. In fact, showers are likely tomorrow afternoon. Humid otherwise, and high temperatures expected in the lower 80s tomorrow. Right now it's 76 degrees here at the University of Kansas in Lawrence, the same in Emporia, 75 in Topeka and Kansas City, 73 in Manhattan, Kansas. Here at KPR, we've got one job, to serve our listeners with exceptional news, culture, and ideas. Your donation directly funds this service that you rely on. So because you listen to KPR, please consider becoming a member listener right now at kansaspublicradio.org. You'll help fund the programming that matters. And thanks for your consideration. Kansas Public Radio, the time is 9:20.
Support for NPR comes from this station.
This is NPR News.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, 91.5 Lawrence, 99.5 Manhattan, and online at kansaspublicradio.org. Coming up at 10 a.m. on both KPR 1 and KPR 2, it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And it's a star-studded edition of the show this week. Among the stars will appear include Ellie Kemper, star of the Netflix sitcom Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and Rian Johnson, the man behind the latest Star Wars feature film, plays a game about the reality show called Storage Wars. That's on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR. It's next in 20 minutes, right here on KPR. Where support for Weekend Edition comes from Pines Garden and Market, featuring a wide selection of perennials, trees, shrubs, growing supplies, and gardening advice since 1962. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. More information at pinesgardenmarket.com. Well, the forecast, sunny, hot today. That's about it in a nutshell, with highs in the upper 80s. Tonight, it'll be mostly clear with some clouds moving in and out, lows in the mid-60s. We'll start the day partly sunny tomorrow, but there is a chance for morning showers. Rain is likely tomorrow afternoon, a 60% chance of rain. In the afternoon hours, it'll be humid with highs in the low 80s. 76 here at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. In Kansas City, 75. 75 also in Topeka. Emporia's at 76, Manhattan 73 degrees. You're listening to Weekend Edition Saturday, and we appreciate it on Kansas Public Radio. We're live. We're local. We're Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, 91.3, and KANQ Chanute, 90.3. Also K210 CR in Atchison, 89.9, K258BT in Manhattan at 99.5. You can also find us on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. I'm Darrell Brogdon for Kay McIntyre this weekend. Hope you'll stick around. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is next on KPR. Today featuring Ellie Kemper of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, actor Richard Grant, and more. That's all next on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Support for Weekend Edition on KPR comes from Eagle's Rest, the locally owned natural mattress and furniture store in Lawrence. With heirloom quality furniture by Acornis, Copeland, Cisco Brothers, and Younger. Online at EaglesRestNaturalHome.com. It'll be a little warm out there today in the KPR listening area. Highs in the upper 80s, mostly clear tonight, mid-60s. Good chance for rain tomorrow afternoon, possibly even during the morning hours as well. 76 is the temperature here at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. It's KPR.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Peter Sagal. On this week's show, it's an all-entertainment edition. We've got actors Richard E. Grant and Ellie Kemper, director Ryan Johnson, and Ruth E. Carter, the costume designer who made Wakanda, our favorite fictional fashion capital. All that, plus we hear the tape from Bill's audition for the latest Garfield movie.
I hate Mondays.
So whip up a nice pan of lasagna and get ready for our news quiz that's coming up right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Biden is ramping up his reelection campaign amid growing calls for him to withdraw from the race. For days, Biden has been seeking to shift the narrative away from his weak debate performance against his Republican rival, former President Donald Trump. NPR's Elena Moore reports Biden defended his record during an interview with ABC News last night.
Speaking with George Stephanopoulos of ABC News, President Biden acknowledged he was worn down ahead of the debate and it contributed to his performance.
It was a bad episode. No indication of any serious condition. I was exhausted. I didn't listen to my instincts in terms of preparing, and I had a bad night.
Biden went on to dismiss a question on whether he would undergo an independent medical evaluation that included a neurological and cognitive test. The president also rejected current national polls, broadly showing him trailing former President Donald Trump. The interview occurred shortly after Biden spoke with supporters in Madison, Wisconsin, where he told the crowd he had no plans to step aside. Elena Moore, NPR News, Madison, Wisconsin.
Newly elected British Prime Minister Keir Starmer held his first official news conference since taking office. Speaking in front of 10 Downing Street today, Starmer said he plans to travel to Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, and back to England before heading to the United States next week.
On Tuesday, I shall set off to Washington for the NATO summit. I've already had a number of international calls, as you will know, and as you would have expected, to establish the relations across with other countries.
Starmer has pledged to reverse hopelessness that grew over 14 years of conservative rule in Britain. The economy, Britain's healthcare system, and immigration were among the top issues among voters in Thursday's national election. Activists in Arkansas say they've collected enough signatures to put an amendment legalizing abortion on the ballot this year. Josie Lenora from Little Rock Public Radio has more.
Representatives of Arkansans for Limited Government lined the hallways of the Arkansas State Capitol Friday as boxes of signatures were delivered to the Secretary of State's office. The Arkansas Abortion Amendment legalizes abortion in Arkansas up to the 18th week of pregnancy. A representative for the group signed an affidavit saying they have collected 101,525 signatures for the amendment. This is more than the over 90,000 needed to put abortion on the ballot in November. The Arkansas Family Council plans to challenge the abortion amendment in court. For NPR News, I'm Josie Lenora in Little Rock.
This is NPR News in Washington. Forecasters say a record-breaking heat wave will continue along the West Coast this weekend and spread into the Pacific Northwest. Officials say more than a dozen wildfires are burning in California, including one near Yosemite National Park. 100 life-size sculptures of Indian elephants are beginning a cross-country journey in the U.S. this weekend. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports the Great Elephant Migration Traveling Art Exhibit is aiming to spread awareness about conservation efforts.
Artisans in Tamil Nadu in southern India made the enormous lifelike elephant sculptures out of Lantana camara. That's the tough, invasive weed that's been encroaching heavily upon the elephants' natural forest habitat, pushing them onto tea and coffee plantations where they coexist with humans. Tash Tekekara is a wildlife conservationist connected with the project.
So it's almost time to change the dominant conservation paradigm, to think of the world as a whole rather than this very binary separation of people and nature.
The sculptures can be seen in Newport, Rhode Island through early September. From there, they will head to New York City, Miami, the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, and finally Los Angeles next summer. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
The Dalai Lama turns 89 years old today. The Tibetan spiritual leader and Nobel laureate underwent knee surgery in New York last month and is currently recovering in the U.S. In a video message today, he told the world that he was perfectly fit and healthy, adding that his health issues are only age-related. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
Here's a look at the KPR weather forecast. A flood warning has been issued for parts of our listening area. It's 75 and fair. Wind is from the south-southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. It's 75 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm the man whose voice is bigger than John Hancock's signature. Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater in downtown Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. Thank you all so much. We are taking this week off to celebrate Independence Day. Not the holiday, the movie. Every year, we here all gather with family and friends and listen to Bill show us how President Whitmore's speech from that movie should be done.
We will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to survive. Today we celebrate our Independence Day.
There you go. I mean, the aliens would have surrendered without a fight, right? So while Bill's doing his vocal warm-ups, we're reaching into the archive for fireworks from our past interviews.
In 2018, we were joined by the actor H. John Benjamin. And if you don't know who he is, you will as soon as you hear his voice.
As the voice of both the animated super spy Archer and of Bob of Bob's Burgers, I asked him which character was most like him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it sort of does follow the current of my life. I started as Archer, and now I'm a little more Bob. So,
you're a little more Bob.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to say this, they sound exactly alike.
I mean, I don't think you're hearing the subtle differences.
All right. could you demonstrate?
Do a quote from Archer and then do a quote from Bob. We'll be the judge.
All right, go for it.
All right, here we go. Ready?
Yes.
I would like a strawberry milkshake and an apple pie.
Wow.
Who was that? Was that Archer or was that Bob?
Well, you could guess.
No, that was unquestionably Archer. I heard it. Yeah, I heard it.
That was Archer.
Yeah.
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 Okay, right. Now do Bob. Same thing. I want a strawberry milkshake and an apple pie.
Okay, ready. Here's Bob. I would like a... Oh God. I know. I don't know if I should. All right. I'll have a strawberry milkshake, I think. And you know what? And an apple pie.
Oh yeah.
There you go.
Yeah, that's cool.
I see that.
Yeah.
Do you get recognized in public? Many people, of course, don't know what you look like, I guess, but they absolutely know what you sound like. Does that ever happen? You're ordering a pizza and people go, "Wait a minute."
Sometimes that does happen, very infrequently. But in my local Starbucks, I don't know if everybody's familiar with Archer, but there's a running gag where he calls out to one of his coworkers, whose name is Lana, who is his girlfriend. And my Starbucks barista was named Lana.
Yes.
Oh.
So the running gag in Archer is I am always calling out like, Lana. Lana! Lana! And for years I did that to my Starbucks barista.
And was she amused?
She was just like totally flummoxed by why I was yelling. And then I would say like about a year and a half ago, I went in and she was like, "I watched your show. You've been doing that for 2 years."
So, John, you've written a book. It's called Failure is an Option. And it is a memoir of all the times you have failed.
I had to leave out a ton of stories.
I don't remember if I actually told the story about failing at it, but one of the things you're not any good at is music, which did not prevent you from releasing a jazz album recently.
Wow! Yeah.
Which is called, I think it's called Well, I Should Have Learned to Play the Piano. Is that what it's called?
That is exactly what it's called,
Can you explain how this came to be, or maybe why this came to be?
It was just an idea I had, a concept I had, and I hired a bunch of professional jazz musicians who then met them at a recording studio, who then proceeded to find out that I can't play piano.
Right. So you just sat at the piano.
I sat at the piano, and I, when they kind of nodded over to me, I like just hit some keys a lot.
Well, I'm sure our audience is wondering what that must have sounded like, and we actually have a sample. So this is H. John Benjamin's jazz record, Well, I Should Have Learned to Play the Piano. Here we go. As you were doing this with these professional jazz musicians, did their level of rage and indignation increase during
the... It started that way, and then it was like a simmer. So they kind of got into it.
Really?
Like we met in the middle at some point.
Did you do any scatting? That would be horrible.
I did like some yelling out, like, "Come on, guys!"
What would have been great is stay with me. Yeah, yeah. Come on, guys, stay with me.
God, like, that's funny.
All right, follow me now. Follow me.
Well, John Benjamin, it is a delight to talk to you, but we have asked you here today to play a game that this time we're calling
Thwack Bullseye.
So you play Archer, Super Spy. we thought we'd ask you about archery, super sport. Answer two out of these three questions about archery, you'll win our prize. For one of our listeners, Bill, who is John Benjamin playing for?
Rob Douglas of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right. You ready for this, John?
I'm ready.
All right. First question. As it happens, archery is the national sport of the nation of Bhutan, but they do it under special Bhutan rules, which includes what little quirk? A, competitors are allowed to attempt to catch the opponent's arrow, in which case they automatically win. B, you are allowed to trash talk your opponent while she tries to shoot. Or C, in the case of a tie, the competitors shoot at each other as a tiebreaker.
I'm going to go with A.
You're going with A, that if you can reach out and snag the arrow out of the air, you automatically win.
Yeah.
No, it was actually B. You're allowed to trash talk your opponent.
Oh, Bhutan.
Bhutan. You're allowed to trash talk your opponent, and you can even stand near the target and wave around and try to distract them.
Oh, wow.
Although that strikes me as dangerous. All right, next question. Recently, a father in Vietnam used his bow and arrow to bring fame to his family. How? A, he won Mr. Vietnam by ballroom dancing with a bow as his partner during the talent competition. B, he tied his son's loose tooth to an arrow and shot it into the air. Or C, his Halloween costume design went viral when he dressed his older daughter as a fully functional bow and she could fling his younger daughter, who was dressed as an arrow.
Well, C is insane. B is radically dangerous. So I'll go with A.
You're going to go with A, that he won the Mr. Vietnam competition by ballroom dancing with a bow as his partner.
Oh, so you're definitely cluing me in that it's not A.
I am.
All right, I'll go with B. Then.
You're right, it was B. He tied his son's tooth. The arrow, shot the arrow in the air. So here's your last question, John. Sometimes archery can be used for practical purposes, as in which of these incidents? A, retired Olympic archer Daryl Pace is hired by Macy's to help deflate parade balloons after the Thanksgiving Day parade by shooting them.
Mm-hmm.
B, a man in Washington State used a bow and arrow to shoot a bag of marijuana into a jail for some friends there. Or C, a woman in Montana was last seen shooting down a bag of chips from the top shelf at a grocery store.
I think I'll go with B.
You're right, it was B. The guy was caught after he shot the pot into the jail with an arrow. He said he was just trying to shoot a squirrel, about which the sheriff said he had no explanation as to why squirrel hunting requires attaching marijuana to an arrow. Bill, how did John Benjamin do on our quiz?
Well, he ruined his record. That 2 out of 3 is a win.
Yes.
Oh, no.
John Benjamin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, John. Take care. Now, a few weeks ago, we went to Seattle, where just before we were scheduled to do our show, I came down with COVID.
Emergency guest host Tom Papa flew in to man the ship. And here's a question that didn't make the final broadcast.
Shantira, researchers in Australia have found an ant colony that responds to danger by having the entire colony do what?
Go to the queen and say, help us.
Would you like a hint?
I would love more than one.
I'd love to give you one. They all draw little X's over their eyes. They don't move, and they hang their tongues out.
Oh, they pretend to be dead?
Yes, yes. They play dead. Researchers discovered the ant colony in Australia on Kangaroo Island.
Mm. Checks out.
Yeah. The researchers stumbled on what appeared to be a whole colony of dead ants, but then one of them moved.
Terry!
Stupid Terry.
Australia's animals are different. Are like, they the size of bees? How did they know?
Well, it is Kangaroo Island, so I'm going to just guess they're the size of kangaroos.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I chased a kangaroo once over a hill in Australia. I went on a little jog one morning, and there was a mama kangaroo and her Joey.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them, and they kind of looked at me, and they hopped over this hill. And I went jogging after them over this beautiful hill. And then I got to the other side, and there was about 400 kangaroos. And I sprinted in the opposite direction because it was terrifying. One was like sharpening a knife on its hand.
Luke, that's not annoying.
Right?
When we pretend that we're dead,
When we come back, the unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, who survived 10 years in a bunker, and director Rian Johnson, who survived dealing with Star Wars fans. That's when we come back with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
It would be hard to name a bigger or brighter music star than Juan Gabriel. He was an icon of Mexican music for decades, turning out hundreds of songs and racking up millions of record sales. A new podcast explores his life, his coyness around his sexuality, and what it means to be queer and Mexican. I'm Adrian Florido. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekend All Things Considered is today at 4 p.m. right here on KPR. From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News. 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and streaming online at kansaspublicradio.org. Thanks for joining us on a Saturday morning. Sunshine this weekend in the KPR listening area, at least today, with a high temperature in the upper 80s. Drop in at Kansas City's Green Lady Lounge any late night and you're apt to see the Reyes Brothers Organ Trio. They're in the spotlight on this weekend's Live at Green Lady Lounge. Join us for an hour of original Kansas City jazz. It's Live at Green Lady Lounge. That's this evening at 6 on all KPR1 stations.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies from nonprofits to the Fortune 500 find food for meetings and company events with online ordering and 24/7 live support. Learn more at easycater.com. Smart Mouth, committed to the prevention of bad breath for 24 hours with zinc ion technology. Smart Mouth products can be found nationwide at drugstores, grocery stores, and super centers, or at smartmouth.com. And Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater in the Fine Arts Building in downtown Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. So, thank you, everybody. We are, in fact, taking the week off to celebrate the greatest movie ever made, Independence Day, which reveals that even though the aliens may have super weapons and giant spaceships, they will still use Apple laptops.
But even they refuse to subscribe to Apple Music.
So while we dress as our favorite characters for the screening we're going to have, we're bringing back some great segments from past shows. Ellie Kemper was the star of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which was one of the best sitcoms of the last decade.
When she joined us in 2018, Peter asked her about an earlier experience auditioning for Saturday Night Live.
Listen, out of the gate here, I reveal that my heart is pounding. I'm an anxious, nervous person, and I'm going to 30 Rockefeller Center to meet Lorne Michaels. Of course I call him Michael Lorne. I mean, his last name sounds like a first name. Not my fault.
So you have this new book. It's called Swirl Days, and the first thing you say in the book is that you say you have to write a book because you're starring in a TV show, and that's what TV stars do.
Yes, it's just a matter of course. Yes.
It's a matter of course.
I wanted to make it clear that I was trying to write a very good book. I hope you like it.
Oh, it is true. It is all the great books, like Moby Dick begins,
oh, yeah.
Call me Ishmael, I'm sorry, but I was contracted to do this.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was great on Bosom Buddies.
He was terrific. He was great. Ishmael was the best. Tell us why you decided to call your memoir Squirrel Days.
One of the central essays of the book is about my ultimately unsuccessful attempt to befriend a squirrel in my backyard, which we all have been there. I mean, I definitely have.
No, I'm just going to stop and say, I want you to finish the story. We have not all been there.
No.
Let's find it. So what happened with you? So you're a young girl. You're in St. Louis, right?
I'm in St. Louis, or I was in St. Louis. I had just seen Dances with Wolves. I was a huge fan of The Secret Garden, and I thought, that's who I want to be. So I went out, and I tried to become one with nature, sort of, like really get close to this plump squirrel who I nicknamed Natalie. And I realized that squirrels don't care. She had no interest in becoming my friend. And I did realize that nature is, you know, ultimately indifferent to us. And it was a hard lesson to learn early on. But
Ellie, maybe the squirrel was just indifferent to you.
No, you know what?
Do you think it was me?
No. It could be.
You know what I think? I think Natalie was its last name.
Yeah.
That's where I went wrong.
Yeah.
Natalie Lawrence.
Do you think that now that you're famous, the squirrel's like, yeah, we were friends? What's interesting about, is this true? We were trying to piece this together. Were you, in fact, a debutante back in St. Louis?
I am mortified that you were trying to piece anything together. I'm living a nightmare right now. Yes, I was a debutante.
Well, you should know that if you don't want people to ask you embarrassing questions about your past, you should probably not write a memoir.
You're not joking.
Yeah.
So I was a squirrel-loving debutante, and that's the truth.
What is a debutante?
Yeah, explain, please, exactly, for those who don't.
Are there people who talk to squirrels in their yards
exactly.
and stuff?
I don't know if debutante society is bigger in... As I said, I'm from St. Louis, so that's the Midwest, but I feel like it's bigger in the South, and it's essentially a... how is there a way to make this sound palatable? It's where young women are introduced to society. Oh, it's hard.
and aren't there special balls at which this is done?
And you wear white dresses.
Yeah.
And wear white dresses and white gloves, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm only 18 when it happened, or 19. So, yeah, no, the whole thing is, it's a spectacle. Maybe some people in the audience were debutantes and know all
no,
that.
No, I don't think so.
No. So you play Kimmy on Kimmy Schmidt, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, show created by Tina Fey on Netflix. And it seems as if that role was written for you. Is that correct?
I think that it was, or I know that it was, which is a huge compliment. I mean, because, yeah, I think it was like, I'm sure there were many people that they were, you know, considering writing a show for, and then I think this idea was their favorite idea. So
well,
that went.
If people don't know it, Kimmy Schmidt is a character who had a terrible upbringing. She was held in a bunker for many, many years, and then the show is all about how she deals with real life as she emerges into it as an adult, and she is absolutely, I guess, unbreakable. She never gets upset. She never gets frustrated. She's always incredibly cheerful no matter what happens to her. And that... Is that the kind of person you are?
Well, some say that the debutante ball was my bunker. No,
yeah.
I think there's a little bit of me in that character, but this will sound so corny, but I have drawn such strength from Kimmy. She is fierce. She refuses to let outside circumstances dictate her own actions, and I really think I have like a fraction of that maybe on a good day. So I really do think she's been through this unimaginable ordeal, and she still chooses to think the best in people, which I think is remarkable.
I do want to reference, because we had him on the show last week, that the big reveal, spoiler, at the end of the first season, that the evil man who kept you in prison is played by John Hamm.
Yes.
Which is hilarious. And we found out he was actually your high school drama teacher?
I know. Is that crazy? He was. He's 10 years older than I am, and I'm younger, no big deal, and he graduated college, and he came back to our high school, John Burroughs School, to teach for a year, and he taught me the improv section of my theater class, which is, it's nuts.
Did you call him Mr. Hamm on set?
I know.
No, she called him Ham Mister. She would just get so nervous.
Yeah, I know.
Every time I'm flustered, it just gets the name flip.
Well, Ellie Kemper, we are delighted to talk to you. We've invited you here to play a game we're calling
Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Meet the Unbreakable Jimmy Smits.
Answer two questions about the distinguished actor, Jimmy Smits.
Okay.
And you'll win a prize from one of our listeners, the voice of their choice, from anyone on the show. Bill, who is Ellie Kemper playing for?
Patrick Hoskin of Los Angeles, California.
All right, Ellie, here's your first question. Jimmy Smits was in Steve Bochco's infamous failed musical cop show, Cop Rock. But that's not his only musical role. He also appeared in what? A, If You Could Read His Mind, the Gordon Lightfoot musical. B, Exorcist, the musical. Or C, Mother Goose, a Rappin' and a Rhymin' special.
C?
Yes!
Wait, was I right?
You were?
Oh my God!
Next question about the unbreakable Jimmy Smits. For a lot of young people, Jimmy Smits is most well known for playing Senator Bail Organa in the recent spate of Star Wars movies. How did he get the part? A, George Lucas's original choice showed up for the interview hungover. B, Smits just showed up on the set in costume and talked his way on. Or C, the casting director owed him some money.
I'm very good at this game. I think I've demonstrated that, so I'm going to go with my gut and say A.
You're right again. That's what happened. George Lucas wanted a British actor to play the role. He showed up. The guy came down all hungover. George Lucas didn't like it. Jimmy Smits got the part.
I love that story. Okay.
All right. Your last bit of trivia about the unbreakable Jimmy Smits. How tall is Jimmy Smits? Is he A, 5'8", B, 6'3", or C, 12 feet tall?
He's 6'3".
Yes, he is. He's 6'3". Congratulations. Bill, how did Ellie Kemper do on our show?
Excellent. Ellie got them all right.
Congratulations. Ellie Kemper, in addition to being a delightful person, has written a genuinely delightful book called My Squirrel Days. Ellie Kemper, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Ellie.
Nice to meet you, Ellie.
Bye, Ellie.
Bye-bye. Bye, guys. Thank you. Unbreakable. Stay alive,
damn it. It's a miracle. Like me, Rian Johnson grew up in the 70s as a huge Star Wars fan. But unlike me, he then got to direct a Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi. And we talked to him back in 2013 when that movie came out.
He started preparing early, making movies with his friends in high school.
Well, they're mostly just, you know, your friends get together on a weekend and you're bored and you've got a camera and you say, why don't we try making a James Bond movie? Why don't we try making a... They're mostly just doing, like, weird little takes on different genres, and they also usually, ironically, involved blowing up old action figures.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, because you're like, what would this look like if we tied a firecracker to this Jawa?
So you were blowing up Star Wars action figures?
Yeah, it would be amazing if you're like, you're sitting there blowing up a Jawa. Little Jawa, you know, the creature from the first Star Wars movie.
Ooh,
and a time traveler shows up and says, Rian, you are not going to believe this. So fast forwarding, you make a number of movies. Your first movie, Brick, was hugely acclaimed, and you made some more films that were just tremendously admired. Tell me about how you got this job. What is it like to be hired to direct the next Star Wars movie?
This came entirely out of the blue. It was, for something that was an incredibly surprising thing, it was presented to me in the most surprising way possible, which is Kathleen Kennedy, who runs Lucasfilm, she called me into her office for what I thought was just a general meeting. I had no idea what I was stepping into. And she basically shut the door behind me and asked me, just dropped this bomb, asked me if I'd be interested in doing this. And I had literally no clue that I was in the running, would ever be in the running for something like this. So it was, I don't remember much about that meeting.
Did they explain what it was about you that they said, yes, you're the guy we've picked?
I had no idea, and to be quite honest, I didn't push them on it.
Rian, Adam Felber here. I've got to ask one question. I love your movie. One thing I really loved about the script is twice in the movie, one of the good guys and the bad guys, Luke Skywalker and Kylo Ren, float the idea that maybe this whole Jedi thing is a terrible idea that leads to a lot of death. Aren't they right?
Hey.
They're not entirely wrong.
I've got one. If we're going to do nerd questions, I've got one.
You guys broke the seal, and now we're going to be here all night.
All right. But there's this rather infamous scene in The Last Jedi in which Luke, as he goes about his day on his remote island, milks this creature. And I just want to ask you, was that the answer to the 40-year-old question, where the heck does Aunt Beru's blue milk come from?
Well, if you want to get technical, no, because it would be a different creature, because that's an aquatic creature, and there's not much water on Tatooine.
Ooh.
So. And also, our milk is slightly green.
I see.
Boom.
Yeah, damn it. I thought I was entertaining the hell out of my friends on Facebook with that theory. Okay, Rian, before we go into the game, I have to ask you about Kylo Ren's pants in the movie. Are you familiar with the Kylo Ren challenge?
Oh, I am indeed.
Yes.
So there's a scene where the incredibly toned and buff and beautiful Adam Driver is shirtless.
Yes.
He had been training at this point for doing intense fighting training for like 6 months, and so he just looked incredible. And he's wearing these slightly high-waisted pants. It's a very distinct look. He looks rad. And who was it who started it online? Somebody famous started a meme where they basically went shirtless with kind of high-waisted black pants and took a selfie, and they call it the Kylo Ren Challenge.
Yeah, so are you buff enough to wear these pants? I have to ask you a question. Were you not allowed to show Adam Driver's navel to the movie viewers of America? Because those are some pretty funny-looking pants.
Do you have a navel rider? No. those were just the pants and the costume. I think.
All right, take off the shirt. That's what you got. Ryan Johnson.
Did you expect a galaxy far away to have lowriders?
I don't know. But I was like, I mean, Kylo Ren is like a terrifying villain. He kills people.
It doesn't mean
he can't have a shiny
navel.
No, and it turns out he wears his pants like my grandfather. They're pulled up.
It was a long time ago.
It's like, and there's Kylo Ren with his pants pulled up past his puppet. Well, Ryan Johnson, it is a joy to talk to you. And as you could tell, some of us could do it all day. But we have business to do. We have asked you to play a game we're calling
Storage Wars.
You are now a Star Wars director, so we thought we'd ask you about Storage Wars. That's the reality show where people guess what's in storage lockers. Now, we have made our own version of that game for you here. So we're going to ask you three questions about storage units, and you will win our prize for one of our listeners if you get two of them right. So, Bill, who is Ryan Johnson playing for?
Sarah Anderson of Salt Lake City, Utah.
All right. Here we go. You ready to play, Ryan?
Let's do it.
All right. First Storage Wars challenge. If you were like one woman in Alabama a few years ago, you could make a cool $100,000 from a storage locker if you just do what? A, rent it out as a waterfront condominium to blind people. B, get locked in it for 63 days and win a lawsuit. Or C, discover it was sitting on a huge deposit of coal.
Oh, boy. I would guess B?
You're going to go with C. No, it was actually B. Get locked in it. No, this woman, she says that she was locked in there for 63 days and no one let her out, so she won a settlement from the storage locker owner.
What did she eat or drink?
She happily for her, she was locked in there with lots of canned goods and juice.
Wow.
The storage locker owner thinks this whole thing was a scam, but still had to pay up $100,000. All right. Next question, if you get the next two, you still win. A storage locker in Michigan was opened in 2009. Now, if you had bid on that storage locker and won it, would you have found A, the world's largest hairball coughed up by a Detroit cat in 1933, B, 4 years of mail a particular mailman did not feel like delivering, or C, President Barack Obama's missing college transcripts?
Well, B made me laugh, so I'm gonna go with B.
You're figuring this out. That's the right one. Yes. It turns out that this letter carrier in the Detroit area just like couldn't handle all the letters that he was supposed to deliver every day, so he would just stuff them into this storage locker he rented, and he did that
for four years.
Yes. Last storage challenge. In 2015, you could have bought a particular storage locker in California for $80, just $80, and it ended up containing which of these? A, a fully functioning meth lab, B, $79 in pennies, or C, a woman who'd been trapped in there for 63 days eating nothing but juice and canned food.
Oh, good. I'm tempted by the irony of B, but I'm going to go with A.
You're right. It was, in fact, a fully functioning meth lab.
Wow.
Hot tip. If you're going to run a meth lab in a rented storage locker, pay your rent. Bill, how did Ryan Johnson do in our quiz?
Well, part of the force was with him. You got 2 out of 3, and that means you're a winner, Ryan.
Again, he's a winner. Ryan Johnson is, of course, the writer, director of The Last Jedi. Ryan, thank you so much for the movie, and thank you for being with us on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Thank you so much, guys.
Bye-bye.
When we come back, two people who couldn't have less in common except their middle initial. It's Oscar winner Ruth E. Carter and Oscar nominee Richard E. Grant on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Director Ty West says people tell him they don't like horror films. Pacific.
Well, what about Rosemary's Baby? No, 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 that's different. What about The Shining? No, 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 that's different. And it's like, no, these are all great horror movies. You're imagining that one bad movie you saw once and then lumping them all together.
So how will they receive his new film, Maxine, with Mia Goth, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News?
Start your day informed with Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m. right here on KPR. From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Tom Harper with Stevens Real Estate, specializing in helping people buy and sell unique and older homes in Lawrence. More information at tom-harper.com or on Instagram at Lawrence Modern. Sunny skies today in the KPR listening area. Today's high should be in the upper 80s. You're listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from DuckDuckGo. Privacy Pro is their subscription service with three new protections, including a VPN. Committed to helping provide extra privacy and peace of mind. More at DuckDuckGo.com/NPR. BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. And BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover a world of British TV, including new original crime thriller, After the Flood, from the producers of Happy Valley, streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater in the Fine Arts Building in downtown Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, everybody. We're here getting ready for our annual showing of Independence Day, the movie, which frankly has a much better plot than the story behind the holiday.
Did Benjamin Franklin ever punch an alien in the face? I think not.
So while we prepare for the big climactic battle reenactment, we are going to bring you some gems from our archives. In 2019, costume designer Ruth E. Carter made Oscar history as the first black woman to win an Oscar for costume design. And then she did it again in 2023.
Before we ask her about her Oscar for Black Panther, we had to ask her about her job.
Now, you're the first costume designer we've ever talked to, so I just wanted to go over some basic stuff. So you're the costume designer for a film. Do you ever have to deal with, like, actor egos, like you pick out the perfect costume for a particular character and, like, I'm not going to wear that?
I guess you deal with actors' egos on a different level. You know, sometimes they say, you know, I can't wear that color, you know, or... But because we're discovering a character, we are both kind of contributing to the conversation.
Right.
So you have to occasionally just say, yes, so maybe your character has a bigger butt.
Exactly.
Yes. So let's get to the fun stuff, which is a movie like Black Panther. Mm-hmm. Comic book movie, fictional, fantastical, science fiction country. You are like the most qualified person to ask about something that I've always thought, which is that a great problem for making comic book movies is that, unlike in comic books, people wearing superhero suits in real life essentially look dumb.
Yeah, because they don't realize it's their whole process to making that thing. You just don't go to the store and get some spandex and sew it up.
No! So how do you make it so, like, the Black Panther, when he's in his superhero suit running around, doesn't look dumb?
Yeah, well, we do a muscle sculpt. That helps.
What do you mean?
And, we take a vacuform kind of mannequin version of Chadwick Boseman's real body form, and we add the clay to his muscles, and we form a superhero kind of a physique.
Are you telling me that that's...
I'm telling you the secret.
That's not all Chadwick Boseman under there?
No, so it doesn't matter how much muscle milk you drink, you're never going to be a superhero. You got to have some clay muscles.
So you're telling me that that, like, amazing superhero suit is just like those padded things that the kids have at Halloween, or, like, the muscles are, like, built in?
Yeah, listen, don't do this at home, kids. It's not exaggerated as you might think. It's just more shoulders, you know? It's not much.
Well, when you make my suit, I want more than a little help.
Okay. So you are now an Oscar-winning costume designer. You've been a leading costume designer many, many films for many, many years. Does that put some pressure on you to dress when you go out in public?
Oh, no. I've always been the anti-fashion. I think that's what makes me kind of unique, that I'm not trying to please or prove myself to anyone. It's not in how I look. It's how I dress other people. Come on.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, how about Halloween? I would expect if you came to my Halloween party, which I hope you do someday, I would expect that you would walk in with, like, the costume. Is this
That's why I don't go to Halloween
parties. Well, Ruth Carter, what a pleasure to talk to you. We've invited you here to play a game we're calling...
I hate Mondays.
You designed Black Panther, so we decided to ask you about the Orange Panther. That is Garfield. The inexplicably beloved comic strip character. Yeah. Answer 2 out of 3 questions correctly, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, the voice of anyone they might choose in their voicemail. Bill, who is Ruth Carter playing for?
Brent and Angie in Indianapolis.
Oh.
Now, you ready to play, Ruth?
I'm ready.
Here's your first question. Garfield was invented by his creator, Jim Davis, back in 1978. What inspired Mr. Davis to create the beloved character? A, his own cat, a beloved tubby tabby named Taft. B, his brother, who was fat, lazy, loved lasagna, and occasionally cleaned himself by licking his hands. Or C, a desire to create, quote, a good marketable character, unquote, that would make him a lot of money.
Oh, his tubby tabby.
No.
Oh.
It was C, he wanted to make a lot of money.
Really? Oh,
he did some research, and at the time there were all these dogs in the comics, but no cats, and he figured there were like 15 million cat owners who might enjoy a cat comic, so he created it to be popular, and it worked.
Got it.
All right, you have 2 more chances here. In 2004... Garfield the movie came out. It was panned by critics, of course. But Garfield was voiced by legendary actor Bill Murray. Why did Bill Murray agree to play Garfield? Was it A, the producers agreed to pay him with a lifetime supply of Italian beef sandwiches from his favorite Chicago restaurant? B, he mistakenly thought that the movie's screenwriter, Joel Cohen, with an H, was Joel Cohen of the Cohen brothers? Or C, he was still angry that he wasn't allowed to provide a voice for the gopher in Caddyshack?
Oh, I'm going to try B.
You're right!
Yeah, that makes sense.
As unlikely as it sounds, he thought that he was doing a movie that was written by one of the Cohen brothers, and he says he didn't realize his mistake until he was in the studio recording his lines, and all of them were terrible. All right, last question. If you get this right, you win. Here we go.
Okay.
Not every Garfield strip has been embraced by his fans, such as which of these examples? A, a 2007 strip in which Odie burns an American flag while screaming death to America. B, a 1997 strip in which John's girlfriend Liz catches him wearing her underwear.
Ooh.
Or C, a series of strips the week of Halloween 1989 written as a horror comic in which Garfield faces his greatest fear, existential loneliness.
Oh, brother. Let's see. I'm going to try B.
You're going to try B, in which John's girlfriend Liz catches him wearing her underwear?
No, wait. No, don't do that one. Let's take C.
So you're going to go for C, the existential horror? That's what it was.
It was hard.
If you've never seen these very real comics from 1989, I highly recommend you look it up. Because Garfield, as opposed to being funny and chubby and angry, he wakes up in an empty house where no one is left. And he spends all week panicking because he's facing his greatest fear.
Oh.
Loneliness. Bill, how did Ruth Carter do in our quiz?
Ruth got 2 out of 3, which is a win for
Yay!
Us.
Yay! I won! I finally... Oh, I won won a second prize.
Yes. It's got to be better, right? It's just all uphill.
Yeah.
It's like Oscar, wait, wait, don't tell me, Nobel. Ruth E. Carter won the Oscar for costume design for Black Panther just this year. A museum exhibit featuring her designs is now traveling the world. Ruth E. Carter, thank you so much for joining us on Wayward Gentlemen. Congratulations on the movie and the Oscar, and we'll look forward to what's next. Take care. The same year that Ruth E. Carter won her first Oscar, Richard E. Grant was nominated for his first Academy Award after more than three decades as an actor. We talked to him before the ceremony.
Everybody say hi, Richard.
Hi, Richard.
There you go.
Hi, y'all.
Oh, you've learned American. Very good. So, as I was saying, I usually ask actors what role they're most recognized for. Usually I can guess. In your case, I can't. So is there a role? Is it With Nail and I, that great cult movie you did a long time ago? Is it some more recent stuff?
It falls into two distinct categories. It's either people old enough to have seen With Nail and I, you know, this cult movie from 1987, or it's that other great masterpiece, Spice World, the movie.
There you are! Do you know, like, what, like, a quintessential Richard E. Grant part is? Like, somebody says, this is the perfect part for Richard E. Grant because it's a...
Because the person is usually on the edge of a nervous breakdown or manic.
Yeah, I would say that your characters all seem either happily or unhappily on the edge.
Unhinged.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for. We also read that you enjoy smelling things.
I make perfume.
You do, yes. How do you go about making perfume? And if you're an actor, is this something you've studied?
Well, in 1969, when I was 12 years old, the first American that I ever met, called Betsy Clapp with a double P, and I fell madly in love with her. She was fast-talking, gum-chewing. She taught me how to French kiss, and I don't know whether you know what that means. It's use of the tongue.
Oh, yes. That has recently arrived here on these shores, sir.
Oh, good. And I tried to make perfume for her out of gardenia and rose petals boiled up in sugar water, just turned into stink bombs, and then finally, 40 years later, I professionally made it as an adult. So it's lime, marijuana, and mandarin are the signature notes of the original scent.
Wait a minute. You just said marijuana?
Yeah.
So, and does this perfume have a name? Is it like, you know, Passion by Richard E. Grant? What's it called?
No, you fool. It's called Jack.
It's called Jack.
It's called Jack. It's unisex, and it comes in a Union Jack bag inside a box, and you can buy it online here and in stores in New York and in L.A.
Wow. And it's very useful if like, somebody catches you and you've been smoking weed all day. You can say, oh, no, you're catching a whiff of my lovely perfume from Richard E. Grant called Jack.
Exactly.
That's a great sales gimmick.
Listen, you've given me the best sales pitch here that I could have dreamt of.
Everything I could do. We read that you're so interested in scent, obviously you are, that you, like, smell everything you encounter.
I don't understand why everybody doesn't.
Who is your best-smelling co-star?
I don't want to offend anybody, because everybody has their own distinct ones. But there are some that I never want to smell again, and I'm not going to tell you who they are.
Right. I do want to ask you about your new film, which is, again, amazing. Can You Ever Forgive Me? You play a real person who really lived and did some unpleasant things. He was, among other things, a bit of a liar and a cheat and a criminal. And did that appeal to you when you got the part, or you were like, okay, that's going to be a challenge?
It did appeal to me because you understand through this telling the story how he falls into this life of crime with Lee Israel, who's so brilliantly played by Melissa McCarthy. And
indeed.
I think that, you know, once you understand why people do what they do, then compassion can flood in. So you understand people and you can feel sympathy for them.
Right. The relationship between your two characters are extraordinarily central to the movie. And I always wonder if actors do this. Did you, like, spend time with Melissa McCarthy improvising, pretending to be the people so you could get to know each other? It was just go on the set? And you were friends or whatever.
I met her on Friday in January, a year ago in Manhattan, for 2 hours. And we had lunch, and then we started shooting on the Monday. And I knew within about 4 nanoseconds of meeting her that we would probably be friends for life, because it felt like lightning in a bottle. So it was just luck as much as anything.
And I'd imagine she smelled wonderful.
She did, and she's having my triplets in August.
No, that's great. How wonderful for both of you. One last question before we get to the game. Let's assume that you win, but even if you don't, getting an Oscar nomination, or hopefully an Oscar, gives you more options in terms of what you want to do next. So you've been doing all kinds of different roles and all kinds of different projects. Is there a dream thing? If somebody says, Richard E. Grant, Oscar winner, what would you like to do next? And you would say...
I want to host your show.
Damn it!
Bye, Peter.
Well, Richard E. Grant, it is a delight to talk to you, as I think I've shown, but we have invited you here to play a game we're calling...
Richard E. Grant, meet Ulysses S. Grant.
So, okay. You may or may not know, we here in the U.S. once had a president named Ulysses S. Grant. He'll probably be the star of a hip-hop musical any day now. We're going to ask you three questions about our President Grant. Answer two correctly, you win our prize for one of our listeners, the voice of their choice in their voicemail. Bill, who is Richard Grant playing for?
Chris Billig of Austin, Texas.
All right, here we go. Grant's original name at birth was Hiram Ulysses Grant, but he eventually dropped the Hiram. Why? A, he disliked being made fun of for his initials, Hug. B, he found out Hiram was the name of his father's favorite mule. Or C, Hiram Grant owed a lot of money to the local saloon, but nobody had ever heard of Ulysses Grant.
C.
No, it was A. He didn't like being called Hug. Apparently, elementary school in the early 19th century was just as vicious as it is today. Next question. One of Ulysses S. Grant's lesser-known claims to fame as a U.S. president is that he had what? A, he had the first known pet fish in the White House, named Ufishes S. Grant. B, according to a historian of hairstyles, Grant had the, quote, hairiest cabinet in presidential history.
I've never heard it described like that.
I'm afraid that, like, hairy cabinet is a euphemism where you come from. It's not.
Yeah.
Or C, he wrote the song Hail to the Chief, which he originally titled Hail to the Me.
I think it has to be the hairy cabinet.
Of course, you're right, yes.
Thank you.
According to the book, 1,000 mustaches, every man in Grant's cabinet had either a beard, a mustache, or exceptional ear hair. All right, last question. It is, as we all know, Ulysses S. Grant first rode to fame and national stature as a general in the Civil War. But that fate for him was somewhat surprising. Why? Was it A, he was so afraid of blood, he reportedly couldn't even look at a rare steak without freaking out? B, his high school voted him least likely to lead the Union Army to victory? Or C, he had a terrible allergy to heart attack.
To what?
Heart attack, which was the kind of biscuit...
That one might keep in a hairy cabinet.
Yes.
I think it has to be number two.
You think it's number...
B.
Wait a minute. You think it was his high school?
Yeah.
In, like, 1834, whenever it was he graduated, voted him least likely to lead the Union Army?
Yes, definitely.
You really... If you want to go with that, I will respect that because I am a fan. So you just make up your mind.
Okay, I'm going with that.
You're going with that. And, you're, and as so many of your characters are, you're gloriously mistaken. The answer was, of course, A, he was so afraid of blood, apparently, that he couldn't even deal with a raw steak. It does make you wonder how, I guess that's why he wanted to win so bad, so it would be over. Bill, how did Richard Grant do in our quiz?
You know, we're going to give it to him because he's starring with one of our hometown stars, Melissa McCarthy, from Chicago. So congratulations. You are a winner, Richard.
Thank you. Have I won like Donald Trump won?
No, yes. Yeah, you won like Donald Trump. And in the analogy, Bill is Putin.
Okay.
It goes as well for you come Oscar night. Richard E. Grant has been nominated so justly for an Oscar for his performance in Can You Ever Forgive Me? Richard E. Grant, thank you so much for joining us on Wait, Wait, Don't Go. What a pleasure.
Thank you, Richard. Good luck.
Bye-bye.
A pleasure.
Bye-bye.
That's it for our Celebrating the Best Movie with the Title Independence Day edition. Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. DuckDuckGo, a subscription to Privacy Pro, includes identity theft restoration, which strives to help restore your identity if it gets stolen with 24/7 assistance. More at duckduckgo.com/NPR. And Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, Benevolent Overlord, Philip Goedeker writes our limericks. Our public address announcer is Paul Friedman. Our tour manager is Shayna Donald. Our vibe curator is Emma Choi. Thanks to the staff and crew at the Studebaker Theater. B.J. Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Jennifer Mills, Miles Dornbos, and Lillian King. Special thanks to Monica Hickey. Our welcome to Earth is Peter Gwynn. Technical direction is from Lorna White. Our CFO is Colin Miller. Our production manager is Robert Newhouse. Our senior producer, that's Ian Shillog. And the executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Mike Danforth. Thanks to everybody you heard this week. That means all of our panelists, all of our fabulous guests, of course. And thanks to all of you here in the Studebaker Theater and everywhere for listening. You're fabulous. I am Peter Sagal, and we'll be back next week. This is NPR.
From the University of Kansas, it's Kansas Public Radio. We're KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, 91.5. KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, 89.7. KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City, 91.3. And KANQ Chanute, 90.3. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or simply tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Stay tuned for Bullseye next with Jesse Thorne. Jesse's guests include country singer Tanya Tucker. Sunny skies this weekend, or at least today in the KPR listening area. Today's high expected to be in the upper 80s. Thanks for listening. Time's coming up on 11 a.m.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia has been running on TV for 20 years. Caitlin Olsen, my guest this week, plays Sweet D. She's the only woman in a cast made up entirely of insane, depraved losers. And she might be the best one on the show. What makes her the best? Well, I told her.
Your character, D's self-obsession, sometimes evilness, stupidity, absolutely keeps pace with the male characters.
Yeah, thank you.
From MaximumFun.org and NPR, it's Bullseye. This week, more morally broken comedy with Caitlin Olsen. Then later, I'll talk with Tanya Tucker, legend of country music. That's all coming up on Bullseye. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Another Democratic member of Congress is calling for President Biden to withdraw his re-election bid. Minnesota Congresswoman Angie Craig issued a statement today following the president's interview with ABC News last night. Clay Masters from Minnesota Public Radio has more.
U.S. Representative Angie Craig says she did not come to the decision lightly, but there is, quote, simply too much at stake to risk a second Donald Trump presidency. She says she has great respect for President Biden's decades of service, but calls on her party to put forward an open and transparent democratic process to select a new nominee. This week, she told NPR News that her constituents don't like their options on the presidential ballot this year, but stopped short of calling on him to drop out following his debate performance. Craig is in a competitive House district in Minnesota. Craig joins a small but growing group of U.S. House members who've called on Biden to step down as the nominee. Biden said he would not do that several times Friday night during an interview on ABC. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in St. Paul.
Newly elected British Prime Minister Keir Starmer chaired his first cabinet meeting today. NPR's Lauren Frere reports the Labour leader has started laying out his vision for the nation after his landslide victory on Thursday that ended 14 years of Conservative rule in the United Kingdom.
It is absolutely fantastic to welcome you to the Cabinet, our first meeting
Keir Starmer says he's getting used to the idea of being called Prime Minister, but is still trying to find his way around 10 Downing Street. During his campaign, he vowed to scrap one of the Conservatives' signature policies, a plan to deport asylum seekers to Rwanda, no matter where they're from. Starmer confirmed that Saturday, calling the plan dead and buried. He embarked Sunday on a tour of the United Kingdom's four nations, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, before arriving in Washington, D.C., Tuesday for a NATO summit. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Tropical storm Beryl is expected to regain strength in the Gulf of Mexico after it was downgraded from a major hurricane. Emily Green reports the storm is heading toward Texas after slamming Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula on Friday.
Beryl has now been downgraded to a tropical storm, but meteorologists warn that it is far from over and is likely to gain power again as it passes through the Gulf of Mexico. Unusually warm water temperatures have fueled Beryl's strength. The National Hurricane Center predicts Beryl will hit Texas between Sunday night and Monday morning. A severe weather disaster declaration has been issued for 40 Texas counties. On Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, Beryl slammed tourist hotspots with 100-mile-per-hour winds that caused widespread blackouts and felled trees. But no casualties have been reported in Mexico. For NPR News, I'm Emily Green.
This is NPR News in Washington. The top court in Kansas has barred the state from enforcing a law that bans a common second trimester abortion procedure. The justices say the ban violates the right to abortion under the state constitution. The court declared access to the procedure a fundamental right back in 2019. Police in Montreal used tear gas to break up a crowd of pro-Palestinian supporters on Friday night. Dan Karpinchuk reports authorities were called to move in after some of the demonstrators started smashing windows at McGill University.
The protest began as a peaceful march through downtown Montreal Friday evening. But at about 9:30, some of the demonstrators arrived at the university chanting, "Divest now," and began smashing windows. Police immediately moved in and ordered them to leave using tear gas on four protesters near the administration building. Earlier in the day, police dismantled a pro-Palestinian encampment in downtown Victoria Square. Mayor Valerie Plante said a public space must remain public no matter what the cause. Meanwhile, a pro-Palestinian encampment remains at McGill University, but school officials say they expect police to remove it as well after talks with the protesters have led to an impasse. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Japan says it's teaming up with Cambodia to share information and technology on landmine removal with nations around the world, including Ukraine. The effort deals with an estimated 4 to 6 million landmines and other unexploded munitions left around countrysides. This is NPR.
Support for NPR and the Tiny Desk Contest comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, VentureX. Capital One is proud to support NPR Music and the Tiny Desk Contest. Capital One, what's in your wallet? And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Now here's your weather forecast for the KPR listening area. A flood warning has been issued for parts of our listening area. It's 80 and fair. Wind is from the west at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Today, clear with a high in the upper 80s. Tonight, thunderstorms with a low in the upper 60s. Then, tomorrow, a few showers with a high in the low 80s. Tomorrow night, a few showers with a low in the mid-60s. It's 80 and fair. Stay tuned for more KPR weather.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you always thought there were no heartwarming lessons on Seinfeld, you should try It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. The latter show has been on the air for almost 2 decades. Caitlin Olson, my guest, plays Sweet D. Reynolds on the show. Olson also performs on the TV comedy Hacks. She plays DJ Vance on that show, the daughter of Gene Smart's character, Deborah Vance. Olson was nominated for an Emmy for her part on that show.
I gotta say, it is crazy she was almost the first woman to host a late night show.
Yeah, and maybe if she hadn't acted like a frickin' pyro, they would have picked it up.
Sounds like it was a dramatic time.
It's always a dramatic time with her.
Yeah.
Do you know my aunt slash stepmom's been trying to talk to her for like 40 years? The woman doesn't let anything go.
When I talked with Caitlin Olson in 2015, Always Sunny had just wrapped its 10th season so long ago. Here's a little bit from the show. In this scene, Dee, along with her equally depraved brother Dennis, are trying to buy guns. Easy, right? This is America. Until the background check.
You've been institutionalized.
Me?
She, yeah.
I mean, one time, for a short period of time, that was against my will. That doesn't even really count.
It's the only time it counts, Dee.
Okay, look, it was like a teeny thing that happened with a college roommate. It was really no big deal. It
says here you burned her.
I burned her, yeah, I burned her. But she was so annoying. I mean, she deserved it, okay? She was wearing my stuff, and she was copying me, and...
You were copying her.
I was copying her, she was copying me. It doesn't matter.
Look, I'm sorry, but I can't sell you the guns.
Oh, well, look at you. Oh, Gunther, the morality king.
Caitlin Olsen, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
I've been watching this show, I guess, now for, what's it been, 10 years?
It feels like 30, but I think, yes, it's 10.
And right from the start, one of the things that I liked best about it was there are plenty of sitcoms with the setup, three guys and a girl, are in such and such situation together, or mm-hmm. two guys and a girl are in such and such situation together. And there are plenty of sitcoms where at least some of the guy leads are mischievous or mean or gross in some combination, yeah. right? Usually in those shows, what happens is that the female lead's job is to wag a finger at the male leads.
Yes.
She doesn't get to do anything funny
no.
or anything.
No. She's the one that's like, you guys, come on, you guys. Yeah. I'm going to point out how funny you are.
And on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, your character, Dee's self-obsession, evilness, sometimes evilness, stupidity, absolutely keeps pace with the male characters.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I... You know, I when I first read these scripts, when they brought them to me, that was exactly how they were, because, and not because that's what they wanted it to be, but because they were writing for themselves.
Meaning that they were that classic sitcom thing of sort of an underdeveloped female protagonist whose job is just to wag a finger.
That's right, because they didn't have a woman in mind, so they just were writing a female role and then really funny stuff for themselves. So I read it and I thought, I definitely want to do this, but I want you to write that for me. I want you to write the guy role for me also, because there's no reason it can't be funny with all four of us. In fact, it seems like it would be funnier the funnier you make it.
I read that you literally auditioned with a scene that was written for two of the male characters on the show.
It was. I didn't even know that because they changed the names, you know, obviously for the audition. So I read the audition and was like, this is amazing. And then I found out later that it was a Dee and Charlie scene, and I found out later that it was a Dennis and Charlie scene, but they didn't have anything funny for the auditions for Dee, so they just had to take something else, change it.
So they,
I felt duped.
Some of the other leads on the show, including your husband, who's the creator of the show, but wasn't your husband at the time,
no.
are writers for the show and sort of shape the show in the writer's room. Did they give you some indication of like what evil things and venal things you did well that they were going to incorporate into these scripts?
Well, it was less that and more conversations with Rob, where he was convincing me that that's the kind of character he wanted to write. But they sort of put that character on the back burner because they were writing justifiably for themselves. You know, I mean, it made sense that they were putting all of their energy and focus making their characters funny. So there are, if you watch the first season, there's a handful that I'm like, nah, it's all right. But I tried to bring as much as I could to it, but I definitely feel like my character gets funnier as time goes on. And they didn't give me examples of what I would be doing. They just, Rob promised me it would be, along the lines of the Dennis and Charlie and Mac characters.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Caitlin Olsen. She's one of the stars of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Hacks.
How would you describe the particulars of Sweet Dee?
So sad. Sad. Really, what I've found with her that makes me love her is that
after all of this time, she's still there. Like, why is she still there hanging out with them? They're so mean to her. And it's so funny to me to think of it in terms of, you know, really all she wants is their approval. Deep down, she would never say that, but all she wants is for her brother to like her and for these guys to think she's good and for someone to recognize any kind of talent. And so she, you know, she wants to come up with schemes too, but I think it's mostly because she's trying to impress them. And I find that so sad. The characters are all dumb and backward and completely self-obsessed and cocky and confident in a weird way, but just trying to prove things to each other.
You know, I was writing a piece about the show the other day, and I was trying to think, why is it that I care about these horrible, horrible people? Because almost never on the show do they make a choice that I support.
No. No.
Like, on a moral level.
Yeah, that's good.
One of the things that I thought of was that there's something about the fact that they are so pathetic.
They're so broken. They're all so sad and broken. And they're clearly their lives, their childhoods were all probably terrible. They all were terrible. And they're broken and they're just trying to like figure it out. And no one's being honest with themselves. I love that the Matt character is just now just completely gay. And that is so wonderful to me because he's like a staunch Catholic and homophobe. Yeah, they're just like broken people who are just trying to scrape their way out for 10 years now.
Wasn't there an episode that was called like Sweet D is Broken or The Gang Breaks Sweet D?
The Gang Breaks D, yeah. Yeah, they do it out on purpose. It makes them feel better about themselves because I was becoming a real downer. The fact that they, at the end of that episode, that they celebrate it as if it's almost like Happy New Year. And they're almost crying with like congratulations for themselves and the champagne bottle. I mean, they're so proud of themselves that they pulled this wonderful thing off. Acting that last scene was so easy because I was like, I was watching Charlie and Rob celebrate and jump up and down and hug each other and almost cry. It was so funny to me. It's so mean what they did. It's the cruel. I feel like that's the cruelest thing I can imagine. That's so funny to me. I don't know why.
There's something just really deeply sad about Dee's particularly.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I think that's true even relative to the other characters on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, I do too. Maybe because she's the only woman. Like, where are her girlfriends? And you're never really wondering why the guys don't have girlfriends, but I wonder why Dee never has a love interest, which is amazing. But like, where are her girlfriends and why doesn't she want to leave? She doesn't own the bar like they do. Why is she volunteering to show up every day? That might be why it's a little extra pathetic.
There's another thing that I think is really charming about the show. You know, in almost every episode, there is a scheme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's essentially the structure of the show. I mean, it might as well, it could be like the Three Stooges or something like that. Like mm-hmm. everyone comes up with this plan mm-hmm. that's going to get them over.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something really joyful about watching a team come together to
yeah.
execute a plan, even if it's just completely
yeah.
immoral.
And give it 100% and like be really proud of each other or proud of themselves for coming up with it.
Do you feel like there's moments on the show where you have to figure out why and how this character would actually do something as horrible as the things that they do? That seems like it must be the nut when they're mm-hmm. breaking a story. That must be like what they have to come up with.
Yeah, and they're very careful about trying to make it. I mean, it's always going to be ridiculous, but they do try and make it. They try and justify it. They try and make it as believable as possible within the realm of this character's brain. You know, they're very aware of, you know, Rob watches things all the time and we'll be there and he'll just point at the TV and be like, we would never do that on Sonny. And Sonny's ridiculous. We would never do that. We would never just make that jump. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that's partly why it works is we make sure that the audience knows that this makes sense to the characters. And I think that's important because you then you can stay with them. I mean, it gets ridiculous from time to time, but for the most part, we really find a way to believe in what we're doing and justify it.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm talking with actor Caitlin Olson.
Did you imagine yourself being funny or being a beautiful ingenue?
Oh, God, no, 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 no. Just funny. In fact, I never thought of myself as beautiful. And I was really not at all during... I got in like a horrific accident at the end of sixth grade, which was leading into junior high.
That's a perfect time to get into a horrific accident.
Yeah, they had to shave my head. It was so... The whole thing, it was so awful. And I had just had like an awful 4 years with girls being mean to me in elementary school. I already was at my lowest, and then that happened going into junior high.
So tell me, what did they have to do? What kind of horrific accident? What did they have to do?
It was a bicycle accident. I was just going downhill. I had just taken my helmet off because I rounded the corner and left my parents' house, and I was the only person that had to wear a helmet back then. So I took it off because it was ugly. And then I slammed on my brakes going downhill, and I flew over the handlebars, and I landed on my face, and my teeth, like the four top teeth, stayed attached, but were kind of in the back of my mouth. And then the bike landed on my head and punched a giant hole in my head. So I had all this like reconstructive surgery on my lip, a giant scar from ear to ear, and a shaved head. And I already hated myself.
Going into middle school? Like,
it literally was the end of sixth grade, which was the end of elementary school. So yeah, like I had that summer to recover, and then I had to start junior high school. And that just like sealed it in. I was very insecure and scared, and I spent most of junior high feeling like that. So no, I never ever thought of myself as beautiful. I think somewhere in the next 4 years tried to find a way to just be in the world, and comedy ended up, you know, being my thing.
How do you think you found that?
Well, I always loved acting, and that was true from an earlier age, even younger than all of this, but I never did it at school because I was too scared. I wanted to be in plays in junior high, but I was way too afraid. I didn't even take a theater class. By the time I hit high school, I started becoming involved in the theater department, and just immediately felt at home and safe, and people were nice to me there, and I made good friends, and I did great plays, and I got great feedback, and then I, you know, we did a couple comedies, and it was fun, and I felt, I don't want to say it was easy. I just felt really comfortable, and I was free to play around, and I enjoyed it, and I got great feedback, and I was like, well, this is better than I've felt in 8 years.
We'll finish up with Caitlin Olson after a quick break. Keep it locked. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
You're listening to Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on KPR. Support for Bullseye comes from Pines Garden and Market, featuring a wide selection of perennials, trees, shrubs, growing supplies, and gardening advice since 1962. Open 7 days a week in North Lawrence. More information at PinesGardenMarket.com. And Kansas Tree Care, local arborists who provide professional tree care in the greater Lawrence area, and who can be reached at KansasTreeCare.com or 785-843-TREE. Today in the Moth Radio Hour, stories of time, its possibilities and its limitations. A secret room, a final basketball game, and a countdown to marriage with no suitor in sight. It's storytelling without a net. The Moth Radio Hour. Today at 5 p.m. here on KPR.
Hi, I'm KT Wigman, Operations Specialist here at Maximum Fun, a workaround cooperative. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and DuckDuckGo. Privacy Pro is their subscription service with 3 new protections, including a VPN. Committed to helping provide extra privacy and peace of mind. More at DuckDuckGo.com/NPR. And Jarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Caitlin Olson. She plays Sweet D on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and DJ on Hacks. Let's get back into it.
The first season of the show didn't have any Danny DeVito on it. FX's identity had yet to be fully established. I think the Shield had been running for a little bit and had given it some credibility, but it was part of an early round of comedy on the network. And, you know, it was a show that had started with just a group of people shooting a pilot on their own. And it was one of the first scripted shows to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's not super uncommon now, but at the time it was a huge deal.
Yeah.
I wonder if when you were making the first season, you felt like you were involved in something that was going to continue to happen into the future.
I loved it so much and thought it was so special and unique and like nothing I'd ever done before, nothing I'd ever auditioned for before. I was so excited about it. I certainly wasn't doing it for the money. And I would say that because we had the support of John Landgraf and we knew that and he was really rooting for us.
John Landgraf being the guy who runs programming at
that's
FX.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he just really believed in Rob and he really believed in our show and he was so on our side that I felt like we were probably going to go for a few seasons, even though not very many people were watching us. We were getting good reviews. We just weren't getting the ratings, but we never would have lasted this long anywhere else. He just was a real champion for us. I would never have guessed 10 years though. Never.
Was it weird when Danny DeVito, the celebrated actor, director, producer, star of Taxi, one of the greatest sitcoms of the 20th century,
right,
was added to the cast of your show?
Yes. We were all just kind of like, what? You know, I think our diehard fans during that first season were very proud to be fans because nobody else knew about it. And they hated the idea because they didn't want to disrupt the chemistry and they didn't want to ruin it with like a Hollywood thing.
It was such a homemade show.
It was. Yes. And, but we didn't have a choice. We didn't have the ratings and FX was like, we don't have the money for marketing. So we got to bring on a big star and get some attention. It was very strange. It was really strange. He was just a humongous movie star and he's so talented and, but he's so fun and easy and had the same sense of humor. Turns out his kids were big fans. Rob went to his house and had a conversation with him and he called him on the way home and told him he wanted to do it. And so it took a little adjusting, but what was the alternative? You know, it was either that or be done with it. And he came in and fit in really well. I mean, any anxiety we had about it was over after the first day of shooting with him. He was so excited to be there and to play. He's got such a young energy. He's really dedicated his life to surrounding himself with younger people, keeping up with technology, keeping himself young. He can stay out later than all of us. He's a great, fun guy with a similar sense of humor, and he just fit in really well. With these characters, too, I mean, he just did a great job of playing the older version of us.
At what point did you start dating the creator of the show?
Right.
At what point in this delicate dance that we're describing of keeping the show on the air in the early years?
Wasn't that a good idea? it was during season two and it was a secret because we were smart enough to know that it was so stupid. But, you know, everything that you've said, every compliment that you've directed towards the show, that's all Rob. So that's extremely attractive. He's an amazing guy. And it was so impressive what he did. And it was also impressive how he runs our show. So then watch him run it and then, you know, write them and in between takes come up with funny ideas for me, things for me to try. He's just a really amazing person and I couldn't help it. I knew it was really stupid. I could get myself fired or we could ruin the dynamic or I could come to work sad. I mean, I definitely had all those thoughts during that first year, but we liked each other. It worked out.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Caitlin Olson of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
What's it like to do the show now, having done it for, you know, in 9 or 10 years relative to what it was like 8 or 9 years ago?
In the beginning, there was a lot of, nerves and excitement and a lot of rehearsing and memorizing. And now I'm so excited to do it and I love it. I'm not anxious. I don't always know what I'm shooting the next day. I figure it out as I'm walking in to rehearse it. We just play around. It's less prepared, not in an irresponsible way, more in a, I find that I'm funnier that way if I don't have it too specifically planned out exactly what I'm going to do and what facial expressions I'm going to make. I'm more relaxed with it. It's comfortable. It's more comfortable now, but I work better like that. A lot of people don't. They need the adrenaline and the anxiety. I don't need that. I need to be comfortable.
Danny DeVito is 70 years old and is been successful in many, many endeavors. So I'm sure he's happy to have had the success that you guys have had on the show. But at any given time, I'm sure it's not that much sweat off his back if it was the end of it. What's it like for the four of you, and especially for you and your husband having created the show, to imagine a world in which the show doesn't exist?
That's a great question, especially for us. That's, you know, we met on it. It's going to be strange when it's just not there anymore. But, you know, by now we've been married for almost 7 years and we clearly have our own life that's separate from either of our work and our kids. And so I think he feels pressure. I assume, I'm sure he feels pressure to create something else that works and not just be the guy who created one show that lasted for 10 years, 12 years. But really, I'm used to him working and me working on different projects. We only come together to work on this for 2 months out of the year. I just want to make sure that I can go on and do something else that's equally as fulfilling, because I feel like I've sort of got the best of everything right now, including my family there.
Do you think there's a potential for dignified roles in your future?
I am a classy lady underneath all of this, okay? So, yes, I will prove it. Dignified. I don't know. Do I want to be dignified? I don't even know that I want to be a dignified character. Look, I'll figure something out. I don't know.
Caitlin Olson, I really appreciate you coming on Bullseye. It was really great to get to talk to you.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Caitlin Olson from 2015. Pick just about any episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and get ready to laugh your rear off. All 16 seasons are streaming on Hulu. Improbably, they are all hilarious. Olsen is also wonderful on Hacks, which is a great show. You can watch the third season of that program on Max. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Tanya Tucker recorded her first single in 1972 when she was 13 years old. It was called Delta Dawn. She cut it with Billy Sherrill, the veteran country producer who had collaborated with George Jones and Tammy Wynette. Delta Dawn is a sad story about a woman who was abandoned by her lover decades ago. It's not really a song for kids, and Tanya Tucker doesn't really sound like a kid on the record. We're going to play it in a bit. You'll hear what I mean. It was a smash. There are dozens of versions of the song, from a copycat recording by the Australian country singer Helen Reddy, which hit even bigger than Tucker's version, to a cabaret version by Bette Midler. Waylon Jennings, Loretta Lynn, Kitty Wells all cut it too. The song launched Tucker's career, a girl with the voice of a woman. Since then, she's released about 24 albums. When I talked with her in 2020, she just cut While I'm Livin'. It was her first record of original material in over 15 years. Eventually, it won Best Country Album at the Grammys in 2020. Tucker has since released 2023's Sweet Western Sound, also great. If you're in Nashville, there's some good news. She has her own drinking establishment. Tanya Tucker's Tequila Cantina features, among many other things, a $300 cocktail, which is essentially a 60-ounce margarita. Seems maybe like too many ounces. Anyway, Tanya is a musical genius, a country legend, and an absolute delight to talk to, as you're about to hear. Let's kick things off with Bring My Flowers Now, which won Best Country Song at the Grammys in 2020.
Bring my flowers now while I'm living. I won't need your love when I'm gone. Don't spend time, tears, or money on my own breathless body. If your heart is in them flowers, bring them home. All the miles cast a long shadow. I'd take a couple back if I could. I'd have learned to play guitar, tell my daddy more I loved him. But I believe, for the most part, I've done good.
Tanya Tucker, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks, Jesse. Good to talk to you.
Can you tell me about where that song that we just heard came from?
Yeah, I mean, I've had it in my back pocket for quite a few years, but just couldn't get it past the chorus. And I walked, Brandy asked me to come in and finish it on the last day of the sessions when we were in California and making this new record. And went in the piano room and, I don't know, maybe 35, 40 minutes, we finished it. And, you know, it just went right to the vocal booth and recorded it. So what you hear on this record is just like it came out of my mouth. There was no fixing anything.
How did you feel working in that context where you were singing more or less as live?
Well, I mean, it took me back to the days when I first started out with Billy Sherrill. You know, the first records I made we made pretty much like that, with live. Everybody is in the studio, you push the record button, and it's all on the same deal. And the only thing they did differently probably was the background vocals we did after I got done singing. But with Billy, back, you know, on Delta Dawn and all the way up to Would You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone, all those songs were recorded with the vocals and the background vocals at the same time.
Let's hear a little bit of Delta Dawn, which was your first hit.
She's 41 and her daddy still calls her baby. All the folks around Brownsville say she's crazy. Cause she walks downtown with a suitcase in her hand, looking for a mysterious dark-haired man. In her younger days, they called her Delta Dawn, prettiest woman you ever laid eyes on.
I mean, you're like 13 or 14 years old.
Yeah.
When you cut that record. I heard that when you were in the studio, not only were you singing it with the band and the backup singers as though it was live, you were just singing it with monitors in front of you, like not even wearing headphones.
Right. No, Billy never would let me have any headphones. So it was a little, I've never seen them since. There were two monitors, one on each side of my head. And kind of like, about 2 or 3 inches thick and very like, maybe a foot and a half tall, square. And, on each side of my head at the microphone, I haven't done it like that since. And, at least this time I had a set of headphones. So we've come up in the world.
I mean, that was my experience of hearing Delta Dawn, which is one of my absolute favorite songs.
Thank you.
Is I had the album. And, you know, I bought it at a used record store or something like that. And, you know, you look young on the cover of the record, but I wouldn't have guessed that enough time had passed and hairstyles had, cycled enough that, and makeup styles had changed enough that, like, you could just as well have been 19 as 13 or 14 on the cover of the record. And it absolutely blew my mind when I learned how young you were when you cut it. But I had that experience again watching Bette Midler sing the song.
In a younger day, they called her Delta Dawn.
It was in her act. I saw her sing it on the Bette Midler show on YouTube. And I was like, this is, it's, I mean, it's literally the same song, but substantively in every way, completely. And I like Bette Midler, but I was like, whoa. So did you hear something in that song that made you think that would be a special song for you personally in a way that was very different from the way it was on the demo or in the record that had been out?
Well, I think, you know, being a kid at that time, I didn't really place any preconceived thoughts or even really think about it that much. You know, I didn't know why I liked it. I just knew that I did. And that carried on later when I saw that so many young people were attracted to this song, not even knowing what it was about. Something about the melody, the haunting melody, but the words. I mean, why would a youngster be so attracted to those mature words? I have no answer for that. I just think it was something that struck a chord with me, and I didn't really think about it too much at that time. You know, the song has something special about it, and I'm not sure you can really put words to what it is.
I want to play another one of your hits that ended up on your second album, and I think that it's another one of my favorite songs ever, and it's another song that has a real intense, spooky edge to it that is made all the more unusual because you were, I guess, 14 or 15 years old when you were singing it. It's called, Blood Red Going Down. Let's take a listen.
We searched in every bar room, honky-tonk as well. And finally, Daddy found them, and Lord, you know the rest too. Hard to tell. He sent me out to wait, but scared I look back through the door. And Daddy left them both soaking up the sawdust on the floor. That Georgia sun was blood red and going down. That Georgia sun was blood.
It's an intense song for a teenager to be singing.
Curly Putman wrote that song, who also wrote He Stopped Loving Her Today and many, Green, Green Grass of Home. But to me, on that song, Jerry Kerrigan playing drums, there's a drum lick riff on there that I've never been able to get anybody to copy it. It's just like certain kind of drum thing that I've never heard on any other record that he did. And it was just, like I say, I've heard these songs for, 48 years, you know. I guess for Delta Dawn, and it would be 47 for this one. But I loved the song, and it was very intense. And maybe, you know, that was part of the mystery of it, is because I was so young. And my dad told me, I mean, when I was a kid, he said, you got two problems. One, you're a girl, and the other one's you're a 9-year-old girl. So he said, you're going to have to sing these songs that you're singing with twice the feeling, because no one's going to believe it. It's not believable coming from a 9-year-old kid. So, you know, he worked with me on that to try to emote what the song was, and sort of a bit of an acting job, but singing instead of acting, and acting it out in my vocal performance. But, you know, I didn't think too much about all that at that time. I just sang it the best I knew how to sing it, and I guess it was convincing, you know.
Even more still to come with Tanya Tucker. After a quick break, she will tell us about the time she met the king, Elvis Presley. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Start your day informed with Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 a.m. right here on KPR. From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence, 91.3 Junction City, and always online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR comes from Tom Harper with Stevens Real Estate, specializing in helping people buy and sell unique and older homes in Lawrence. More information at tom-harper.com or on Instagram at Lawrence Modern. Sunny skies today in the KPR listening area. Today's high should be in the upper 80s. You're listening to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on KPR.
I'm KT Wigman, operations specialist here at Maximum Fun, a workaround cooperative. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and BritBox, dedicated to helping people discover British crime series, including new seasons of Silent Witness, Blue Lights, and The Responder, starring Martin Freeman. Streaming at BritBox.com/NPR. And DuckDuckGo, a subscription to Privacy Pro, includes identity theft restoration, which strives to help restore your identity if it gets stolen, with 24/7 assistance. More at DuckDuckGo.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Tanya Tucker. She is a country music singer who has been at it for over 50 years. She recorded the hit song Delta Dawn in 1972. She won a Grammy for Best Country Album in 2020, which is when we talked. Let's get back into it. When you were a kid and a young teenager, before you started recording for record labels, your dad won money in a Keno game to pay for you to make a demo, spent 2 days playing Keno straight to do it.
Yeah.
Did you know that was weird at the time?
You know, I didn't even know it, really. I didn't even know he was doing it. He just came in about midnight when my mother and myself were at our little old trailer we lived in St. George, Utah, and said, "Mother, Tanya, get up. We got to go. We're going to make some demo tapes. I just won some money." So we got in the car and went right to Las Vegas, and he'd set it up where a guy named Cotton Harp was here, and I don't know how he met him, but he was a bass player, and he had a family, so we stayed with him and his family while we were, you know, just stayed here a couple of days. Went in and did 6 songs in about 3 hours. That wasn't normal. Looking back on it, it wasn't normal, but nothing was normal in my early days, or it don't seem to be very normal now either. I mean, I've just had a very abnormal life that is not a life that everyone would have been good for everyone, or anyone else, really. It was just singularly mine.
What else was not normal about your early days?
Just all kinds of things that, when Jimmy Durante was playing the Arizona State Fair, we went up there and from Wilcox and in Phoenix, and I saw him at the Coliseum getting a hot dog in the afternoon, and my dad said, "There, go get him." So I went over and said, introduced myself and said, "Mr. Durante, I'm Tanya Tucker, and I'm 11 years old, and I really would like to get started as a singer, and really would like your advice on that." And he said, "Well, come back after the show. Let me hear you sing." So we were watching the show, and Rex Allen was about to introduce him, and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, we're sorry. We've had an accident. Mr. Durante was coming on stage tonight, and he fell. And they've had to run him to the hospital, emergency room." So my dad doesn't stop there. I found myself in the hospital room at the hospital with Jimmy Durante in bed, talking to his agent. He had about 92 stitches across his face. He fell and cut his face open, and they'd stitch his face up. And he was talking to his agent and said, "I can't believe we didn't do the show. You know, the show must go on." And then he looks up and sees me and my dad there in the hospital room and hangs up the phone. And, of course, you know, my dad's, "Man, we're here to let you hear my daughter sing." So I did. I sang to him. And, you know, he loved it. But I guess he did. He was very nice, very kind. And but those things aren't normal, you know. And my dad was not a normal human being.
Did your folks travel with you when you were on the road as a teenager?
Oh, yeah. They were with me all the time. And then later on, my brother and my sister, we were all on the same bus, and it was kind of a family affair with the band. And so we all rode on the bus, and it was tight, but I'd drive relief drive sometimes, even though I didn't have my driver's license. I would drive, and we did what we had to do to get through it and get to the next show.
What'd your brother and sister think of it?
My brother drove. Oh, that was normal to them. It wasn't, you know, they'd already been through that. My brother especially. We all learned to drive at a very young age. I always think I was about 4 or 5.
Tanya, I'm not talking about what your brother and sister think about driving the bus. I'm talking about what your brother and sister think about being on the road with a band.
Oh, well, you know, it was just kind of a normal thing, you know? It's just like we're all in this family together, we're going to get through all this and we're going to prevail and have success and we'll all be successful together.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with the country singer Tanya Tucker.
Daylight or midnight, red eyes and that old hat, whiskey bent, busted flat. She's a credit to her flaws. She's a bad risk, but a good friend. Small chains and loose ends. She only regrets that she might have been a little faster on the draw. Those old high-riding heroes, there anywhere the wind blows. She's been to hell in Texas, and she knows how it feels.
There were two things that I imagined. And like I said, I really don't know because I wasn't there, but I'm going to tell them to you in case they make sense to you or don't make sense to you, either way.
Okay.
One of them was, I was thinking, what an unusual situation it must be to be a teenager in a world of adults where you are, and I'm talking about basically everybody in your life besides your siblings when you were a teenager.
Right.
And like constantly having to demonstrate that you belong there. When you goodness knows you had the talent to belong there. I don't think that's a question, right? And you had the skills as a performer to belong there. I mean, you were an incredible singer when you were 13 years old. But you didn't have other equipment to belong there, I'm sure. You know
right,
what I mean?
Like, right, right.
You're still a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old or whatever.
I really wanted just to be one of the boys. And in fact, that's one of the songs I wrote for this album that I've been holding on to for about 10 years that I've been working on. It's called One of the Boys. It's not hard for a girl like me to be one of the boys. And I really just wanted to be one of the boys. I mean, I wanted to be Elvis's buddy. You know, they had no visions of me going into his bedroom or anything closer than that. I just wanted to be a friend that maybe I thought maybe he might need. And it was hard to get through, especially to men, that I was not a girl. And I mean, I was just a girl is all I'm saying. And get past that to be friends. And, you know, sometimes I still have that little struggle, but it's not as big as it used to be. But that was one of the things, but also just talking to musicians, that were older than me, that were much more experienced and much more knowledgeable about music than I was difficult for me to tell them what to do. And that, not that I could tell them how to do it right. I just knew they weren't doing it right. And, that was a difficult problem for me. Very, very difficult.
You know, I heard in you talking about Elvis just now, something that I probably, because I'm a guy, had not thought about. So tell me if I'm misreading the situation, but I am guessing that one of the biggest problems when you were a young woman was in finding belonging or seeking belonging was not just that you were much younger than the people around you. You know, that you were a 13-year-old or a 17-year-old and you were around 25-year-olds or 35-year-olds, but that you were a woman in a situation where most of the people around, whether it was in the industry or your fellow artists, were men.
You know,
your band was probably almost all men and, you know, so on and so forth. And so, you know, when you are seeking regular friendship belonging, a lot of those men might have been seeking something else.
I mean, very true. I mean, that was not a problem. I mean, it was definitely a hiccup every now and then, you know. But, you know, I just learned how to get through that. And it's hard to kind of work through that and figure out how to handle those kinds of situations. My dad was very good about helping me with that. He gave me a lot of advice. You know, when I walked out that night to meet Elvis Presley or to see his show, because I could never afford to go. And even if I did, I wanted to meet him when he knew who I was, not just some random girl, you know. I wanted him to know me. And so I waited and then I got invited to see his show in Las Vegas, and me and my sister went. And on the way outside the door, my dad opened the door of the trailer house that I lived in Henderson, and he said, "Listen here." He said, "That boy can have any girl he wants in the world." He said, "Just let him know he can't have you." And I never forgot about that. And so later when, you know, Elvis asked me to come backstage, and I went back, and all of his cronies, where they were kind of getting a little nervous because he hadn't come out to say hello to me yet. And, you know, I know the whole score now because that, you know, I've been there, done that. And, they, you know, they couldn't give me a drink. I was underage, you know. I remember looking back, it was like, "You want some peanuts? You want some M&Ms? How about some, cashews?" You know, they were just, "How about a Coca-Cola?" You know, and I just said, I looked at my sister, and I said, 5 minutes, we're out of here. I'm not waiting for him." And they got, and I think someone must have went back and told him, because it wasn't 5 minutes and he popped out and talked to me. And then, of course, at the end, after we talked a little while, he went to kiss me, and he went to kiss me on the lips. And so I gave him the old side cheek, you know, and I think that I saw the biggest smile I'd ever seen on his face. He got it, you know, he got it. And he thought it was pretty amazing, I think, at that age, that I could act like that, you know. The last thing I wanted him to think of is I want him for any other reason, you know, than to just be a buddy.
I'm Jesse Thorne. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm talking with Tanya Tucker.
What was it like for you as a lifelong picker of hit songs, a person who one of your great skills that I know you were very proud of was choosing the right material for yourself, recording great songs, and you've recorded so many great, you know, country story songs,
yes,
and, you know, songs that were not direct representations of yourself and your story.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm...
To have two producers on this record come in and say, "Hey, we've written some songs. They're kind of about you." And you don't get to pick them necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, ultimately, I had the decision whether to do them or not. And I had decided not to do them. I mean, several times they tell me. But I talked to
him. You don't remember, Tanya?
No, they said
I did read a quote about you.
I canceled it four times, but I don't remember that. I just really, really have had an innate ability to pick great songs, and not just for me, but for other people. I have a really kind of I don't know if it's a talent or what, but to be able to put a song with the right singer. And I've done it so many times that I know that I'm good at it. And this time I really didn't think these songs were going to be good enough. And I've never been prouder to be wrong, but I was wrong about that. And people have really been attracted to this new album. And through all the kicking and screaming and digging my feet in and having me drag me to L.A., it's just, I'm just glad I did it. You know, it's like, whew, I'm glad I worked out for 3 hours, you know. I feel much better, kind of like smoking, you know. You quit smoking and you think you're always proud of yourself, but what it took to get there is really difficult. And I went through a lot of, you know, doubts. That's all I had was doubts. You know, I always have a few doubts about anything, but this was overwhelming. But I'm glad I did it. You know, it just shows me that maybe I'm not an old dog. I'm learning new tricks, you know.
Well, Tanya, thank you so much for coming on Bullseye. It was a real dream to have you on the show. I really appreciate you taking this time.
Thanks, Jesse. It was great talking to you. I'd talk to you any day. It's easy. I mean, you make me think, so I wouldn't say it's easy, but definitely make me think.
Well, I'll take what I can get. Thanks again.
All right. Thank you a lot.
Tanya Tucker from 2020. Her newest album is called Sweet Western Sound. Let's go out on a song from it. This is Breakfast in Birmingham, featuring Brandi Carlile.
You know me, I'm still moving, just as slow as old molasses. Bacon cooked up good and crisp for gone. Moved into Alabama in a purple Firebird.
looking for some love.
That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. This week, though, I went to the A, San Francisco, California, my hometown. Got to see the Giants have a bottom of the ninth inning comeback. Great tribute to Willie Mays. Got to hang around the mission with my friend Javaka. A good time. Love you, San Francisco. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Danielle Huesias. We get booking help from Merritt Davis. Our interstitial music is by Dan Wally, DJ W. Our theme song is Huddle Formation by The Go Team. Thanks to The Go Team. Thanks to their label, Memphis Industries. We are on Instagram at Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I personally am on Instagram at Jesse Thorne, very famous. You can also find us on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook. And hey, how about taking this opportunity to recommend one of the interviews that you heard today to a friend? It means the world to us. If you hear something great on Bullseye, share it with somebody. Because, you know, nobody else is going to do it except you. Please do it. We appreciate it. Thank you. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. I'll get breakfast in Birmingham.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
From the University of Kansas, it's your place to find NPR News, Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia, KANV and KANV HD1 Oldsburg Junction City, KANQ Chanute. Listen online at kansaspublicradio.org or tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Stay tuned for This American Life. It's up next. Support for Bullseye on KPR comes from First Presbyterian Church in Lawrence, with services online on YouTube and in person. Every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. for community building, worship, and music. Information at firstpreslawrence.org. Sunshine today in the KPR listening area. Warm temperatures in the upper 80s. It's KPR.
Next time on KPR Presents, she's been called the nation's hostess, Mrs. President, even Lady Presidentress.
First Lady is not elected. It's not a constitutional position. There is no legal authority. They get no salary. And until Rosalynn Carter, they did not even have an office space.
Diana Carlin is the author of not one, but two new books about the changing role of the First Lady. I'm Kay McIntyre. Join us for KPR Presents, 6 o'clock Sunday evening on Kansas Public Radio.
From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. I'm Robert Glass.
Okay, so we're going through the gate here into the park.
Yeah, we're going. This is our morning. This is the morning walk into the park. So everybody will split up into their different sections and get the park open, and we'll start putting out prizes and getting.
We're at an amusement park in Kansas City, Missouri, called Worlds of Fun. We're going to be spending the entire hour today at amusement parks. It's 5 minutes before opening, and I'm walking with Cole Lindbergh, who's 25. With permanently mussed hair and the cheerful vibe of the Bosom Buddies era Tom Hanks. He's been coming to this park since he was a little kid, started working here as a summer job at 14, and then basically just never left. It became his real job. 11 years later, he is a full-time, year-round employee.
I love amusement parks. Anytime my family would go on vacation, we'd schedule it around an amusement park because I love roller coasters, because I loved amusement parks. I mean, I've walked this pathway that we're taking right now. I've walked it thousands and thousands and thousands of times.
When he was little, his family had season passes here, and they would come a lot. He traveled to any new roller coaster to try it out, daydreamed about a job where he would design parks and build roller coasters. And when his dad drove him here at the age of 14 for a job interview, he wore a suit to that interview. just sitting inside the park's offices, which are utilitarian. Picture the principal's office at a public high school. Even that was exciting.
I remember being like, kind of like, oh wow, this is the inner sanctum, you know, this is the inner working, this is where all the cool stuff happens. And then, you know, then first time actually getting in the uniform, actually working in the park. I mean, I remember, to me, it was like, wow, this is kind of surreal, you know, I'm actually working in an amusement park now. And that, to me, that was kind of like, awesome, you know, that was awesome. I'm so excited about this.
You might think that enthusiasm would diminish over time, but what's incredible about Cole is that even after a decade here, even after becoming an adult and working 60, 70-hour weeks every week all summer, even with the pressure in his current job of running a whole department and hitting financial targets and buying all the supplies and hiring and supervising over 100 young people, he is still pretty psyched about working in an amusement park. And it is not a glamour job. The department Cole runs is the games department at Worlds of Fun. This is 32 games, the kind that you would see at any carnival or midway, where you get, you know, three softballs to try to throw them into a milk can, or you throw beanbags at targets, or you shoot darts to knock over a stack of cups. Nobody comes to an amusement park for the games. Cole himself never went to an amusement park for the games. But he's an extrovert, and he has filled the department with extroverts. Like Mallory. The park is barely open, hardly any customers here at all, when Cole stops by her game on his morning rounds.
Yeah, Mallory loves talking on the mic. Mallory does a good job on the mic.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Let's hear it. Go for it. Try to get people to play.
All righty. We're over here at 3-Point Challenge today looking for our first winner. You come on over here. You have 40 seconds on the clock. 12 shots up. And you could be walking away with some awesome prizes.
This is exactly how Cole trains the kids to talk on the mic. Don't stop. Get a flow. Have fun. If you have fun, that's what's going to sell the game. Watching Cole run the games department at Worlds of Fun is watching somebody who was raised here and who completely, thoroughly mastered everything. It's rare to witness somebody so happily great at any job.
All right, let's gather around, guys. Is there still people in cash control? Anybody know?
It's the first shift meeting of the day. About 30 teenagers and college kids mill around a big tree before the shifts start.
All right, guys, listen up. Gather around. Let's do this. Here we go. Shh, quiet please, real quick. Here we go. Today is Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Today is a busy day. Today is the day that we have a very good day because there are going to be a lot of people playing games. And today, of course, is one of my favorite days of the season. It is the second round of the Sweet 16 tournament. Let's take a look. Sam, you want to hold this up a little higher? Okay, we've got...
One of the guys, Sam, holds up a poster board with tournament brackets on it, like for any sports tournament. The Sweet 16 tournament pits the kids in all 32 games in the park against each other in pairs in a four-week competition to make the most money. Last week, half the games were eliminated. Cole is here letting the remaining games know who they're competing with today.
Pigs of Fury Bullpen versus Goblet Toss Lions Den. Now, hold on. Before we go any further, could this possibly be a precursor for today? Yesterday, the number one game in the park was Scale Africa.
Okay, Scale Africa is a scale, a game where they guess your weight or age, and it's in the Africa part of the park, hence Scale Africa. And it's no surprise that it's number one. It always makes tons of money. All the games in the park are grouped together into four different teams, which they call Games 1, Games 2, Games 3, and Games 4. And these four teams, Games 1 through 4, compete against each other all summer long, like teams at summer camp in a three-month-long color war. Most other amusement parks don't go this far to make things interesting for the workers. This park, Worlds of Fun, is owned by a company called Cedar Fair that owns 11 amusement parks and 6 water parks. And Cole knows the guys who run the games departments at the other parks, and some of them do competitions like this between the employees.
But I don't think they do it to the extent of what we do. I mean, every year I talk about, you know, we had the deathmatch tournament. We had the Sweet 16 tournament. A couple years ago we did a thing called Toss the Boss. And basically what happened was is that every single day I'd pull a game out of the hat. And if that game was the number one game in the park for that day, then that section would get to throw me in the pond. The pond is not a good-looking pond. It's gross, and, you know, it smells. And the deal was is that if you are the number one game in the park, you get to throw me in the pond.
So finally one day, the game that he picked from the hat that day tried their hardest and actually became the number one game in the park for the day. And... Of course, they made a video about this because, you know, it's present-day America. And Cole went and told his peers, his colleagues, the guys who run the games departments at the other parks, all about what happened.
I go and I tell the other parks about this, and I showed a picture, you know, like, oh, there's me all soaking wet. And, I kind of got laughed at. You know, like, why would you ever do that? And to me, in my mind, I was just like, why would you not do that? You know, why would you not want to get people excited about working in the game that they're in? At least they may try. They may do a little bit more. And if I can get a little bit more out of them, we're good. Even if the game only makes a little bit more money.
Also, it's more fun for the kids.
Exactly. It's all about more fun. All right, so there's a lot of people in the park today. Now, I have composed a song about today, which I now want to sing for you. And you can all sing along. Okay. Saturday, it's Saturday, 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 Saturday.
Wait, what day is that? I forgot.
It's Saturday.
Oh, okay.
Today I don't feel like riding any rides.
Whistle, whistle.
I just want to play all the games. Like playing Mamba Ball when a giant top frog or a big basketball. Yesterday I don't feel like riding mini rides, just playing games. Alright, let's have a good day, guys. Everybody in, alright? Alright, games on three. 1, 2, 3. Alright, let's have a good day.
Well, today on our radio show, we go to amusement parks all over the country. We see stuff backstage that we had no idea was going on. Like that song. We hear Jonathan Goldstein's story about moving to the Jersey Shore for a summer when he was 16. And we hear your stories. We asked you to call in with your amusement park stories, and you told some great ones. Today's show first ran a few years ago, but we're airing it again now because it's summer, it's a holiday weekend, it's hot. Let's spend an hour at the funnest place possible. Let's ride the rides. Let's gorge out on terrible great food together for this hour. Cue the roller coaster sound now. Stay with us. Back one, Game Boy grows up. Following Cole Lindbergh around on his early morning tour of Worlds of Fun Park, I learned a couple things. First of all, people play the games because they want to win the prizes, and so an important part of his job is actually guessing what prizes are going to excite people.
You kind of just go, it is what it is. Oh, I got to show you the lemur. You want to see what a lemur is?
Yeah.
People love these. This is a lemur. People play for this all the time. This is one of our number one prizes.
Really?
Yeah.
Who'd have thought? It's a fluorescent colored monkey the size of a teddy bear with huge eyes and a super long tail. When they put it into the dart game became one of the most popular games in the park, doubled its business. I also learned that Cole invents games.
You like Angry Birds, right?
We round a corner and I see why he asked.
What we're looking at right now is a giant slingshot with a launcher that you launch basically beanbags at pigs. And wow. we built this.
So you got permission from the Angry Birds people?
Well...
This turns out to be kind of an awkward question. Cole points out that this slingshot game is not actually called Angry Birds.
It's called Pigs of Fury. Pigs of Fury. So now, this is one of our number one games. People love shooting a giant slingshot.
Before I flew out to Kansas City to meet Cole, I watched his YouTube videos online. Yes, he has YouTube videos, and I heartily recommend them. They are shot, directed, and starring Cole. They are low-tech, they're low-budget. In this one, he wears a Viking helmet and a fake mustache and wire-rimmed glasses, and he's walking through a video arcade. Those are his echoey footsteps that you're hearing. Next, he's inside what looks like, you know those old arcade machines with the mechanical claw that picks up prizes? This one is big enough for a person to stand inside, and Cole is inside it, surrounded by huge stuffed animals, and he raps. Okay, I'm going to stop the video right there. When he says a bear, a dog, and a giant monkey, then we have three quick shots of stuffed animal prizes. A bear, a dog, and a giant monkey.
Sometimes people just don't play games. I'm asking how they're doing and they say they know.
As the video continues, the teenagers on his staff join him and they're all dancing around and they're hitting whack-a-mole moles on the beat. And everything that they do in this video is so deeply uncool that you know that they must really like and trust each other. And their total commitment to what they're doing actually flips the dorkiness and makes it kind of cool.
Get it in the can. Get this ball right in the can. You can do it, man. Just get this ball right in the can. Cause all I want to do. Come play my games. Come play my games.
There are over a dozen videos, all set in the amusement park, with the stuffed animal prizes always playing surprisingly central roles, like the sci-fi special effects movie they made where a mysterious ray from outer space hits and the stuffed animal prizes all come to life seeking vengeance. Key line?
The prizes attacked me. I was in my game. The earth shook, and next thing I knew, I was being pummeled by bears.
The only semi-normal video of the bunch is a training video. This one opens on Cole. He's in a suit and tie in front of a bookcase reading a book. He looks up, startled, as if the camera surprised him.
Hello! How are you? I was just reading. Welcome to the World of Fun Games training video. My name is Cole. I'll be taking you on this wonderful journey. Here.
When he says wonderful journey, he mugs at the camera with this gesture that communicates the idea, I know this is completely ridiculous. In fact, the entire video seems to be making fun of the idea of training videos while at the same time it is a training video, explaining how to sign in, how to use the till card, how to stock prizes. I saw these videos and all I could think of was, these people really love their jobs. And I thought about Michael Scott, the fictional boss on The Office.
I'd say that there's a lot of Michael Scott in this job. I'd say there's a lot of Michael Scott in me, probably. I do silly things that everybody looks at me later and go, why did he do that? Why was it deemed necessary for Cole to dress up wearing a big beard and a raincoat and tell everyone he lived downtown under the bridge and he was there to motivational speaker them today? Hi, everybody, I'm Phil Bridges, you know, and like go out and talk to people. What went through his thought process? And I've run out with a squirt gun all the time. I got my big super soaker, and on busy days, I'll take the super soaker and I'll fill it up with ice water and I'll sneak around the corner. Just there, I'll stand there and I'll just go, light them up! Just so I spray across the whole group. You know, that's what makes it fun. They're gonna remember Phil Bridges more than, you know, like anything else throughout the day. And so if they're talking about, did you guys see what Cole did at the shift meeting? Even if they say, that was stupid, or that was not funny, they're still going to be talking about it, and that's still going to get them happy about this job.
So, does that work in practice? After all, if you think about it, amusement park jobs are not, on their face, very fun. You know, taking tickets, strapping people into rides, convincing passersby to throw three balls into a can. Well, the Saturday that I visited turned out to be one of the busiest, hottest days of the summer. There was a concert at the park which brought in thousands of extra people. And of course, this was Sweet 16 Round 2, which did seem to matter to the kids. Before the shift, Haley and a couple of the other kids from Games 3 pulled Cole aside and crowded close so kids from other teams couldn't see.
So this is, you have a secret weapon that is going,
they're going
to show you the secret weapon of what,
and only anybody see. Guaranteed victory.
Guaranteed victory.
So. It's a banana costume.
So,
a banana.
Is that?
You made the costume?
I made the costume, yeah. She's awesome. because we have a game with bananas that's in Sweet 16. So we're going to have somebody running around in this costume to try to sell it.
It's kind of big, and it's kind of rough because I didn't use the pattern.
Wait, David, light's coming. Put it away. Put it away.
Did you just go buy fabric?
No, I've had this fabric. So this is the head hole, the arms hole, and it's going to look like the bananas in Lions did.
I like
it.
We're
pumped.
Is that exciting?
That is more than exciting.
People are going to be stopping, taking pictures. Oh, maybe I'll win one too.
Meanwhile, the guys in Games 4 were doing great in Sweet 16. All their games had survived the first round. Games 1 was eliminated completely in the first round of Sweet 16. As for Games 2, Max and Uksan are pulling a double shift, hoping to break the record for how much has ever been made, ever, in their two games. Their not-so-secret strategy.
All right, so strobe light, strobe light. You want two black lights out there.
Max and his team leader Dominic are setting up at a game called Rollerball, which is one of the older games in the park. Basically, it's just a ski ball, but as you get points, it moves a little wooden pig, which is in a race with all the other riders. This doesn't make any sense. It actually doesn't matter. Here's what you need to know. Games 2 is hoping to turn this creaky 16-year-old game Rollerball, which never does well, into a crazy dance party they call Techno Ball. Max and Dominic have brought in a disco ball. They brought in lighting gear. And Dominic is explaining to Max how he wants to set it all up.
Yeah, we're going to put a light on that toy chest. We're going to put a light on that box. They're shining at the disco ball. Disco ball is going to be moving. It's all dark in here. People want to walk on it. They'll be like, whoa, what am I stepping on? What?